Thank you, Mary. I want to again thank your group for coming and joining us Tuesday night. It was a great commitment. And got to be honest, I'm a little nervous here today. We've got Rebecca and I so far. So I think I'm going to just pass it off to Rebecca and I'll finish it up.
Great. Thank you, Gail. Thank you guys for having us. Yeah, we're from the Big A in York, Maine. We meet on Tuesday nights, you guys know, because you were there last night. My name's Rebecca, and I am an alcoholic. So what I noticed, so I'm the bookie for our group, and my sobriety date is November 10th of 2014, and I know I've been a bookie pretty much almost my whole recovery. I've been a bookie. I got sober in Rhode Island. And so I noticed it, the same kind of thing, Gail. I was like, tried to text a couple people just to like pull some other people in. And I get really nervous too. Like, I think like, oh my gosh, like either A, I have to talk a certain amount of time, or, you know, make sure my message is, you know, I'm sharing the message and whatnot. And I haven't been to a daytime meeting in a really long time. And being a bookie has really helped me stay sober. And my group has really helped me stay sober amidst everything. And I've been slacking in my meetings is the point I'm getting to, but I was definitively always opening up our meeting on Tuesday nights. Like no matter what, by hook or by crook, I was getting there. And then last night I couldn't, I had to work. There was like no way that I could manage even turning the meeting on last night. So, yeah, I missed you guys last night, but I'm glad I got to come today because I need meetings. Like meetings helped me from the beginning and meetings help me now. And I know that. And, you know, my disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and likes to keep me busy in all sorts of ways and keep me away from meetings. So I'm really grateful to be here. Like I said, my sobriety date is November 10th of 2014. I heard someone say the other day, and I really, really do believe I got here the day before I was going to die. Like I was so sick and so desperate and mixing so many different drugs and alcohol and everything together that I really think my body was just going to shut down and I was going to die from abusing drugs and alcohol the way that I was. And I'm really, really grateful. I'm really, really grateful that I got here, and I'm really, really grateful that I was given that gift of desperation. One of the first meetings I walked into was a step meeting. I think it was like a 12 and 12. And I can't really remember, but whenever someone new came to the meeting, they read through step one. And in there, in one of the paragraphs, it said something about, you know, as desperate as someone like hanging on to a life preserver, if you guys have read it, you know what I mean, but it's like, you know, you're holding on so tight, right? Like as desperate as the dying can be, like those two phrases I heard and I was like, how did they write a book like knowing what I was feeling and what was going on with me? And one of the first things I heard besides that, when other people started sharing, was hope. And I had been so hopeless for so long that hearing, you know, a couple little words here and a couple little words there gave me something to cling on to until I could get to another meeting. And that was my early recovery. You know, I was blessed in the fact that I got a sponsor like immediately. Someone offered to be my sponsor, which I know doesn't happen around here like very often. I have a God shot sponsor story. My this was along the same day. It might have even been that same meeting that I'm talking about. I was heading to, and where I lived, where the meeting was, there was a lot of one ways. It was in East Greenwich, Rhode Island, and up on, they call it the hill. There's a lot of one ways, and I was coming up to a one way. It was turning into a one way intersection, and the other car was coming the other way, and neither one of us knew, like, did we have the stop sign? Did that person have the stop signs? We both stopped and waved each other on. It was one of those awkward, you know, moments. And we both pulled around opposite sides of the church and wound up parking, like, nose to nose. And we got out of the car and kind of laughing. I'm half crying. And, you know, she's like, oh, are you new? Like, and I said, yeah. She's like, are you going to the meeting inside? And I said, yes. And, you know, I think at that point I must have just broken down into tears. I cried a lot early in recovery. And she said, you know, do you have a sponsor? And I said, no, I don't. She said, well, do you want me to be your sponsor? I was like, okay. Like, I was just, I didn't know what I didn't know. And what I know now is, like, I desperately needed that woman. And a huge fan of sponsorship. You know, she was retired, I was crazy, and it was just a perfect, like, match. I could call her whenever I needed to, which was a lot early on, because I did not know how to breathe a sober breath. And this woman just, like, so gently, like, guided me through just really how to live, like, day to day. And you know, she told me a lot of things. Some of the things that I remember were, you know, to join a group. I didn't know what that was, like, what that meant. And she said, well, it's, you get a home group, and that group you make it to no matter what. Every week you make it to that group, no matter what. She said, so go to a group and, you know, just listen. And when you find one that you feel good in or whatever, you know, go to the person and just ask if you can join the book, join the meeting. They'll put your name and your sobriety date in the book, and that's it. And I was like, oh, okay. So I listened, and I wound up joining a group. And my first home group, we met on Sunday nights. We were a commitment group. And she told me to get a job in my group. So I didn't know really what that was either. So at first, like, they would just, like, the newcomers could do, like, greeter or the chip person. So there was this other kid that I got sober with. He's, like, my sober BFF. And we both joined the group at the same time. And so we decided, we volunteered to do, like, the chip club. So probably for, like, the first 6 months, I did the chip club. And then I had another God shot happen to me. I was just shy of 6 months sober. We were having a business meeting, and the group that I belong to in Rhode Island had, you know, their group conscience read that certain roles in the group, you had certain amounts of recovery, and you would be eligible to serve in those positions. So the position of bookie was coming up, and I was not yet 5 months sober, but this old timer who was another person that wound up, like, becoming such a near and dear person to me in my recovery, like volunteered me into bookie position. Said, like, I nominate Rebecca into the bookie position. And I was like, I can't be bookie. I don't have 6 months sobriety. And he was like, well, when does the role start? And it didn't start for, like, a couple more weeks. So he's like, you'll have 6 months by then. And I was like, oh yeah, like, I will. So he's like, yeah, she'll do it. Right. So next thing I knew, I was the bookie for a commitment group. And reason why I say that's a God shot is because, I really believe that my job in my group has helped me stay sober throughout my recovery. And I'll tell you why. Not only do I think that, you know, I feel a responsibility for my group in having a job and showing up for other people, I feel that reaching out to other alcoholics, like I have to, it's my job. Like I have to reach out to other alcoholics and set up commitments. And when I first got sober, I met someone who like gave, like they like threw these books from like probably 6 months, a year, right? These like calendar books at me. And someone gave me like a list of phone numbers, and I just had to start like going through, and I had to start reaching out and calling people. And Rhode Island's a very small state. You guys know, you're in, you know, if you've ever, you've probably been in Rhode Island, right? If you're from Massachusetts. So it's a wicked small state, but they have like very, like they pack a lunch to go from like South County to like Woonsocket, right? It's like, they think it's like a big trip. So like I would be calling people up in like Northern Rhode Island that would know like people in my group and be like, oh, you know, is Big George still there? And asking me questions and just like engaging me. And I'd wind up on the phone with another alcoholic for, you know, 20 minutes, a half an hour, just talking about recovery and, you know, and our groups and the importance of, you know, anything that, you know, having the job. And, you know, he appreciated me reaching out to him. And it just gave me almost like a sense of, it was like a sense of worth again. It started giving me a sense of purpose, right? Like in my recovery. And the other part of belonging to a group for me, like having a sponsor for me, gave me the opportunity to trust, or start to trust, I should say, one other human being, right? Like I started to reach out and call this woman that I didn't know and tell her when I was struggling with my stinking thinking, like the thoughts in my head and how to proceed with my life. Like, what do I do next? Right. I started to trust this woman because she was really, you know, steering me in the right direction. Oh, maybe you need to go to another meeting, right? Get a group, join, you know, join a group, this and that. Joining my group gave me the opportunity to start to get to know like the smaller, larger than one, but smaller than a big group, right? Started getting to know like a small community of people in the program and going to the same meeting and showing up early and, you know, helping set up and all that stuff. Like, you know, you start to get to know more people and feel a connection. I started feeling a connection again towards other human beings. And then like reaching out to people in my job. Now I'm, you know, speaking to people that are well beyond my comfort zone, but still like everybody's just welcoming me in to my new role, right? Like we're all just alcoholic. We're all just, I'm just another bozo on the bus, right? Going along, doing the best I can, worried I'm not doing a good enough job, but having these people that I don't even know like support me in that and support me in staying sober, like one day at a time. So those suggestions were like a godsend to me. And I wish I could say like I was perfect at those things, but I am not. I do not, you know, in any way, shape or form pretend to be. I struggle still with reaching out to my sponsor on a regular basis. I really struggled with the suggestion of getting on my knees. I had a huge chip on my shoulder when I first got here about the word God. Like I could not stand it. I was like, you guys, I grew up in a Catholic church. Like I don't know what, I mean, maybe that's why, but no, I'm joking. I had a serious chip on my shoulder about God, and I came to learn, you know, through the help of my sponsor and going through the steps, that, you know, I had a resentment. I had a significant resentment about some things that had happened with me growing up, you know, with the God of my understanding. So I really fought the whole like getting on my knees thing. I used to smoke when I first got sober. I was still smoking. And my sponsor would say, like, throw your cigarettes under the bed because, you know, you'll get on your knees to get your cigarettes from under the bed. So I'd throw my cigarettes under the bed at night, and in the morning I would like intentionally not get on my knees. I would just bend over and get, I'm so like defiant by nature. I go, someone tells me what to do, I want to say no, like it, I want to do the opposite. It's just in me. And I fought that and I fought that and I fought that. And I believe that contributed to a relapse that I had early on. And even after I came back and after this sobriety date of November 10th, I still struggled getting on my knees and praying to a higher power. And finally, someone said something to me about it just being like an act of humility, you know, showing that you're willing to do like anything for your recovery. And it made it okay for whatever reason, you know, and I started getting on my knees. And then more recently, my husband likes to rip stuff apart in the house and decide we need to do a new project. And we have about 8 of those going on in my house right now. So I have no carpet on the floor in my bedroom. So I've been using that as an excuse, like, not to get on my knees. And my sponsor, who's like 78, was like, Rebecca, like, if I can get on my knees, you can get on your knees. I'm like, okay. Because I will make, you know, my disease will, it will get in there and say like, oh, you don't need to get on your knees. You've been doing that, you know, it's going to hurt, or, you know, if the floor is too hard or whatever, you don't need to do that. And little by slow, then, you know, I find that I'm not going to as many meetings as I was going to before. I'm feeling disconnected from the people around me. I'm getting snippy and angry at my children and loved ones. Like, anything I've ever wanted in my life, I've had to work for. And I really want to stay sober, and I have to, for me, take certain actions to assist me in that. And I still, you know, I still have a group. I still have a job in my group. I volunteered for the bookie position when I moved up to Maine 2 years ago and joined the Big A. And I was just thinking today, you know, I'm comfortable in my role as the bookie, which means I should probably pass it on, right? Like share the opportunity for service with someone else and maybe get into my comfort zone. But we can talk about that at a business meeting. You know, I cannot use words, I think, to really truly describe where I was and where I am now. My first couple of years in recovery were like really, really rough. I mean, I sat in an AWOL with a bunch of women probably in my second year, and I would show up and just like listen, but I couldn't like do any of the work. I was just so broken inside. I really, really, really struggled. Like I was in so much pain, right, that I couldn't even begin to look at the things that I needed to look at until I had what I think, you know, God determined was enough, you know, recovery, sobriety, and tools in my belt to finally do that. So I don't, you know, I understand some people think like you get sober, you work the steps, it's an immediate thing, it's what you do, right? For me, it took me a little bit longer, and that's okay. Like, I think we're all on our own road and we all have our own process, and it's really to thine own self be true. And I want to say why for me, I think that was the right thing. Very briefly, and then I'll pass it over. When I was like 3 years sober, I had some things that started coming up for me that I didn't remember, like that happened to me as a child, like these suppressed memories, and they were very traumatic. And I think that prior to, you know, me being sober for that amount of time, I think if any of those things had come up for me, I really don't think I would have stayed sober. I really think it would have been too much for my little, you know, attempting recovering brain to manage. And I think I would have used. So I had the support system, you know, three-ish years in, I sought outside help. I needed outside help. So I had, you know, really like this team of people, I feel like, between the women I had in recovery and the women I had in like my outside help people, that kind of like scooped me up and just like walked me through this like really brutal time. It was a very raw time for me. I don't know how else to explain it other than I felt like I was walking around in like nature without like my outside skin on. Like I just constantly felt like, ick, I'm exposed. It was so awful. But I got through it, right? Like I got through it with the help of my my sponsor and the other women in my group and outside help. And little by slow, you know, things continue to change. Somewhere around 4 years, I figured, you know, after being single for close to a decade, that I would, you know, try out this whole dating thing. And I met someone online and we got married 4 months later and I moved to Maine. And I am in this like blissful state of like, you know, joy on most days, I have to tell you. I love Maine. I love my husband. He's just absolutely amazing. And, you know, even through like this pandemic, my life really hasn't changed that much. I've been really blessed. I've still been able to work. My kids have been working still. My husband's been working still. And we do a lot around, I call it the compound, you know, around our house on a regular basis. So, which we were doing before. So I feel like really lucky that I pretty much go to work, come home and like go to the gas station. But that was kind of like what I did before. We didn't really do much before. So I feel really blessed. Even though I'm like over it, like I know I'm not the only one, like I'm over it. Like I want to hug people again. I want to see like my group members in person again and eat cookies with them. And, you know, like just, that stuff. Like I miss that stuff. So, that being said, really grateful. I hope that there was something in there that you guys were able to hear that was helpful. The other thing, you know, besides getting on my knees was the praying part, like praying to a higher power. So my sponsor told me originally, because I didn't know how to pray, like, do you know the Our Father? And like I said, I'm Catholic or grew up Catholic. So yeah, of course I did. She said, well, you know, if you ever say those words and think about them, like that pretty much covers your bases for praying for now. And I was like, okay, cool. So I would just do that, right? Like I didn't even know. And now I really like the third step prayer. We have a meeting up here on Monday nights called Drop the Rock. We do a Drop the Rock meeting on step 6 and 7. And that's another thing I really, even though I do believe God brought me to my husband because he's amazing and awesome, I think that that was something that was lacking in my recovery down in Rhode Island, was really like in-depth look at some of these things and a spiritual aspect of my recovery in regards to meditation. And coming up here, I had an opportunity to go to like 2 meditation meetings a week and the 6 and 7 meeting. And it really started like bringing me down another road, like another branch of my recovery. And I think that I was missing that stuff. So I think that was another reason why, you know, God led me in this direction. So, you know, I can't say that I don't ever have any issues with the word God anymore but I use it to describe my higher power just because it's easier. I have a version in my head of a higher power. You know, sometimes I say the universe, sometimes I say God, sometimes, you know, whatever, but I know it's not me. That's the most important thing. And I know that like that higher power has my back and that I can reach out for help when I need it. I was told, you know, there will come a time in your recovery where there will be nothing or no one in between you and a drink or a drug except your higher power. And I did have that moment. And I did need to get on my knees and ask God to help me stay away from the drug that was like right in front of me, which was my drug of choice. And I, you know, I had to get on my knees and pray. I was like terrified. So, hey, like the program works. I don't know. Like it works if you work it, right? We used to say like one of the meetings I go to, it works if you work it. So work it because you're worth it. And I didn't understand that phrase either. It was just words that would come out of my mouth. It was like the little chant they said at the end. And I didn't really, really hear it until a couple of years in. And then I was like, wow, like there's so many little things around here that we have that are really, really powerful. They come in the forms of suggestions. They come in the forms of those, like, you know, Boy Scout banners and little chants. And I think people in the program too. So thank you guys so much for having us, and I will pass it over to Miss Gail.
Thank you, Rebecca. It was great hearing you. And we've got another one of our group members showed up. Better late than never. Thank you, Steve, for coming. If you want to share for a bit, and then I can finish it up.
That sounds great. Thanks. It's good to be here. It was nice to listen to Rebecca, best bookie in AA. And I'm glad I'm a member of the Big A group. It was great to hear you guys the other night. We appreciate you sharing with us. I got a really lot out of what that woman, Jeannie, said. She talked about Quaaludes. I remember Quaaludes. I liked those too. And I liked a lot of things. And I liked all the things that were not good for me. Anyway, somehow I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous due to the grace of God coming into my life and saving me. You know what I mean? My story is I started drinking when I was a young kid, and I don't know where or when I crossed the line, but I know I crossed it. You know, I say this in my story all the time. I had one grandfather. I never saw him drink, and you know, some years ago I found out why. You know, because his father was a vicious drunk, and then I had another grandfather that made wine in big giant barrels. And I really liked that grandfather. And I joke about this all the time. I was drinking wine coolers before they got famous, you know. And anyway, I tell my nanny, she'd give me some wine with a little ginger ale in the glass. And when I got a little older, I'd say, you know, a little less ginger ale, not a little more wine, you know. And the story goes on from there, you know what I mean? I was drinking before it was legal. In high school, somebody in my class broke into City Hall. I got sober in Malden, Massachusetts. And they broke into City Hall, and we had a whole box of ABC liquor cards. And everybody was getting one. You know, we get on the beach, we get our picture taken in a little photo booth. We'd find somebody that could type on a typewriter and put this little card in, and we were good to go, you know. And I became the buyer, the big shot, and I got into drinking, you know. And, you know, before that, before the ABC liquor cards, it was Friday, Saturday night, waiting for the buyer, giving him the money, and hoping he came back with your booze, you know. And you know, life went on, you know, life went on. And yeah, I got a little older. I got out of high school. I went to work. I got out of high school in 73, and you know, I went to work, and by the end of the weekend, I was borrowing money from my parents to put gas in my car, because I was out on the weekends drinking it away, you know. And so I went to college for a couple of years, and I figured I'd get a degree and try to become something in this world. So I went to Wentworth Institute in Boston. I got a 2-year engineering degree, and then I went out in the workforce. And now it's 1976. I married my high school sweetheart. Off we went, you know. Two young people, it was party time, and that's what we called it, party time. And and my children were born in 1982 and 1984. By this time of my drinking, you know, I was a working, functioning drunk, I guess. You know, I brought home the money most of the time. By now, I found private clubs. I was hanging around with the boys more than I was hanging around with my family. And then the end came, you know. I was arrested again for another drunk driving. I was 40 years old, and my whole life was going to change before me. And I had a whole bunch of charges against me, driving to Windsor. I hit a woman getting out of her car. She went away to the hospital in an ambulance. I was in a blackout. I didn't remember that. But the judge was reading me the riot act. I had an open container between my legs, grass under my seat. I was going to see my local coke dealer. My whole life changed before me. Anyway, I got a chance and a choice from a judge to either go to prison or go through a program in Waltham, Mass at the time for dual offenders like myself. And I went through that two-week program in Waltham, Mass, a state-run detox by the state of Massachusetts. And I learned about alcoholism. I learned that I had this thing, and I learned that I better do something about it. You know, and so I did. You know, that I left that detox, and they said to go to a meeting as close to your house as you can get it. And it was no coincidence that I lived three blocks from a sober club called Club 24 in Malden, Massachusetts, on 787 Salem Street. And I straddled my ass down there. I went to a meeting. People surrounded me and helped me. It's funny how they know you're new, you know. I remember that day, too. They knew I was new, you know. And anyway, they helped me a lot. They gave me a meeting list. They told me about other meetings. They said to keep coming. Those are the two most important words I ever heard in my life. Please keep coming. Under in any and all conditions, you could stay sober. I remember hearing that. They said try 90 meetings in 90 days. You know, if you got this thing, you might want to stick around. Anyway, I've stuck around for a little while, and I had some wonderful teachers. I got a sponsor. I went to meetings. I joined groups. I got active in my recovery. I got active down at that club. I got involved. I really got involved. And long story short of it all is you know, I've stayed sober a day at a time since. My sobriety date is August 30th, 1995. And I haven't found it necessary to leave here yet. I've had a pretty good ride here. I'm very grateful to be sober today. I'm grateful I'm in recovery. I'm grateful I can attend a meeting like this in the afternoon. We used to call them loony noonies. You know what I mean? And I went to a few of those. My sponsor used to say if I wanted to test my sobriety, try to go to an afternoon meet, you know. And anyway, it was interesting. I've been to all kinds of meetings. You know, 16, 17 years, I went to a step meeting at a woman's house in Melrose, and got involved in the steps of recovery, which I try to practice on a daily basis. You know, I get up this morning, I ask God for help. I ask for God's will, not mine. I pray for the sick and suffering. I pray for my family and my friends. And I ask God for, like, big, giant words. I learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous, patience, understanding, tolerance, acceptance, and love. And I try to incorporate those in my daily routine. I make a lot of mistakes, but I try my best. You know, I try to help a newcomer whenever I can. I try to stick my hand out, and my suggestions and my advice once in a while. And, you know, I always want to help. You know, I know it says that in our preamble in the first sentence and the last sentence, try to help others. Like people tried to help me, you know, they didn't want nothing from me. They just wanted to help me. They wanted to help me stay sober a day at a time. And I've been very blessed. 4 years ago or so, my wife and I sold our house in Malden. We moved up to Maine. I live in New York, Maine now. It's so beautiful up here, I can't explain it. If I ever heard somebody talk about Maine and it was a shitty place to live, I'd tell them to see a doctor, you know. And anyway, I have quite a life today. I spent 20 years in engineering. I got out of corporate America. 23 years ago, I started my own business. I'm a finished carpenter by trade. I'm working on my shop today down in the two-car garage of my home. I'm very, very, very blessed. And if you don't think you can be as blessed as me, please keep coming. I've got quite a gift today. I know why they call it the present, because it's what's going on today for me in my life. And, you know, along with prayer in the morning, I pray for my immediate family. And at the end of the day, I thank God. Like before I go to bed tonight, I'm going to thank God for just another day, you know, another day of recovery. This weather's a little crazy up here today. It feels like winter again. Might have the wood stove on later, but my wife and I bought a beautiful home up here. It's very peaceful and serene. And my whole life I was looking for peace and serenity. And I found a little bit of it, you know, and I know that I'm a lucky, lucky guy. And I'm thinking of something that's at the top of my mind here. Last night, me and a couple of guys, we started a little step meet, and we had a new guy come in. So the guy said, "Where should we start?" I said, "We should start at the beginning." So we started and we read the doctor's opinion. And, you know, there's a new guy that was involved with our group. I think he's 6 to 7 days sober today. And so we welcomed him in. And, you know, we told him to come back next week. We do the same stuff next week. And maybe we'll start at step two, you know. And so it's nice to be able to do something like that for someone, you know. And we're going through the steps out of the big book. Like I was taught to go, go through those steps. And, you know, I've gone through the steps multiple ways through a 12 and 12. I've been through several AWOLs. I've gone to spiritual retreats. Whatever I can do to take part in my recovery, it was funny.
Can't hear you, Steve. There's a problem with the sound.
Have I had some issues in sobriety? Oh, yeah, I've had a few issues. And did I want to drink? I don't know. You know, a couple of times I was angry. I lost a son in recovery. My youngest son, Joey, he was 16 and a half years old. It was like 20, 21 years ago now, and I miss him a lot. You know, I talk about my children all the time. On the other side of that, my oldest son, Chris, he'll be 39 this year. I have two little grandchildren. One of them is 5 and one of them is 2. They're so beautiful. I can't even explain that. They're gorgeous little kids, and I'm the grampy that can stay sober today. You know, and anyway, I'm rambling on here, and I'm going to share some time with Gail. It's beautiful to be here, and I have another grandchild coming next month, a new little baby girl. And it's funny, growing up, we had boys, and now we got girls as grandchildren, so it's pretty cool. And anyway, long story short, it's great to be here. Thank you for having us, and I wish everybody a safe and sober day, and keep on your recovery. Thanks a lot.
Awesome, Steve. Thank you so much for coming in. What a great share. So, hi, I'm Gail. I'm an alcoholic. Excuse me. My sobriety date is October 16th, 2010. I got sober back in Western Massachusetts in Westfield. And that's where I grew up, and I lived till I was about 47 years old. My experience, you know what? I don't have like any, you know, big thing. I started drinking in high school. I just had friends all the time, and the surrounding and my jobs and everything were drinking and partying. That was the norm. That's what we did. We went to work, you know, earlier years, you went to work, you know, you went out on the weekends. And then for me, it just started where it kind of, you know, got to be a little bit more and more where I was, you know, I probably turned that corner. And I was partying almost every night. It's funny when I hear somebody was talking, I don't know if it, Steve said something about the Quaaludes or whatever. And, you know, it's funny when back in my earlier days, when somebody would have something, I'll try it, give it to me, give me more, you know, it wasn't just like, you know, I could do one hit of mescaline or something. I had to try to do two or eat the whole bag of mushrooms or do this, you know, that pattern of always needing more was always there for me, you know, even as a little kid with candy and toys and all that. You know, I can see that I always needed more. So I had my oldest daughter. I met her dad. Her dad and I met on New Year's Day in a bar. And we were together for about a year and a half, and I got pregnant. And I had my daughter Jillian, and I was 27 years old. And if I stop and I think, that time that I was pregnant was the longest time of not drinking from, let's say, 17 to when I got sober, when I was like about 46, 47. Otherwise, you know, there was always beer in my hand. There was always, I was a big pot fan, always smoking the pot. And I always worked. So that was my excuse that, you know, I worked, I paid the bills. We had a nice house. We lived on the water. We had a boat. You know, my daughter was taken care of in my mind. You know, we had all the physical, you know, the material things is what I'm saying. So I really didn't think I had an issue. And I don't think anybody else really thought I had an issue, probably until I turned 40. You know, Gail was just a big partier. I drove drunk all the time. That was my nemesis at the end. Was the drinking and driving. That's what really got me in a lot of trouble. Yeah, once I was 40, I think it really kind of went downhill. I worked at a golf course in Feeding Hills, Mass. And I had ended up working there for 20 years. And I would either stay after work and drink there, or I would bring drinks home with me from there, and always knew that there was drinks. You know, there was booze at the house, and it just escalated and escalated and escalated. And my boss at the golf course, who was also a very good friend, started backing away from me the last summer that I was drinking, that I was working at the golf course. And I couldn't understand why. I didn't get it. You know, he didn't put it out there what it was, but I didn't get it. And what I ended up finding out is it was my drinking. My last drink was taken at that golf course on September 17th. There was a glow ball tournament. And I had a ride there. So I was like, I had an excuse, you know. I was shit-faced when I got there. And it continued. And I had gotten strikes against me from my boss. And I was on my third strike. And when I woke up that next morning, that Saturday morning after that global tournament, I knew that I had crossed the line. And I knew that I knew I didn't have a job anymore. And I don't remember why I knew that, because I didn't know what happened the night before. But I just knew it was bad. And I woke up that morning, a beautiful, beautiful fall morning, sunny, blue, blue skies. And I was laying in bed and I just knew that, you know, the gig was up. I finally had the realization that my drinking was causing me and all the people around me a lot of chaos, a lot of hurt. And I guess when I heard the saying that I was sick and tired of feeling sick and tired, and when the first time I heard that, that's what it brought me right back to that moment laying in bed. And I knew that I couldn't drink anymore. I knew I had to stop drinking. And I was fortunate enough to have friends at the golf course and have a cousin who were in the program. And they would always make little jokes. You know, Gail, there's a seat waiting for you, which I never understood. But, you know, I get it now. I called my cousin, and there was a big book in the house. My oldest daughter's dad, he had done a drunk driving stint, and we had a big book. And he said, Gail, get that. And Steve mentioned, he said, read the doctor's opinion. So that was the first thing I read in the big book. And I'm actually working with a sponsor now, and we're going through the doctor's opinion. The doctor's opinion just took everything and made so much sense to me. It made me realize that I wasn't unique, that I had a physical allergy to alcohol that caused a craving. And I could see all this. I could, you know, I had the clarity while I was reading that to see the steps on how that happened to me. And so I was very fortunate that reading that, you know, I think I hadn't drank in probably about 7 days when I read that, that kind of gave me hope. And I had enough hope to reach out to another friend, and he brought me to my first meeting, which ended up, we were there, we got there late. It said 7 o'clock, or it said 7:30 in the book. It started at 7, but I met women there. And they told me about another meeting. And so I went to that meeting the next night, and I got a ton of phone numbers. Everybody just came over when they realized I was, you know, new, and were just so welcoming. And it was, you know, it was almost overwhelming how welcoming they were. So I got another big book, and it had a whole bunch of phone numbers in it. And I did end up losing my job because of that globe all night. I was fortunate to get laid off, so I really didn't have to worry about money for a while. And I decided, you know, I had to change my life. And I figured if I could spend a half a life drinking, I could try to figure out how to spend a half a life not drinking. And I kind of figured that AA seemed like the best, safest place to be, because I had seen people in my life who it had, who it was working for, I should say. So I did the 90 meetings in 90 days. I did more than that. I did a 7:30 a.m. I did the was a Looney Noonies. We had a lot of those back in Western Mass. There was some clubs that did different noontime meetings, and I really immersed myself in the program. And I thank God that I had the wherewithal to do that and to stick with it. I got a sponsor probably 2 or 3 weeks in the program, and I would meet up with her. I was driving all around. I was all around Western Mass. I was in Springfield. I was in Wilbraham going to meetings, you know, some meetings in Southwick. You know, so I wasn't even hardly home anymore. I was out doing meetings. And I needed to do that because my head was so screwed up, because my thinking was still so screwed up. If I wasn't reading something, talking to somebody, or, you know, or being at a meeting, this head was so screwed up in resentments, sorrow. I felt sorry for myself because of my drinking. I had lost a relationship I shouldn't have been in anyways. I was with a man for 20 years, and this other man already had somebody he was supposed to be with. But all these, this whirlwinds of thought going through my head, and the way I could have those stop was by going to meetings, reading AA literature, talking to people in the program. It took me a really long time to sleep. I think I didn't probably sleep a full night for about 2 or 3 months after I stopped drinking. And my sponsor always said to me, she said, "Gail, that's because your body's not used to falling asleep. It's used to passing out. So figure all the time that you drank, you know, give yourself a break. It's going to happen." I mean, I was, that was back like when the Eye Touches first came out, and I had one next to me playing meditation music all night long. So if I woke up, I'd hear that and hopefully it would, you know, put me back to sleep. But I'd say, like I said, for 2 months, that evil 3 o'clock, I was up. And I remember when I was drinking too, even whenever I passed out, I was always back up. It seemed like that my younger daughter calls it the devil hour, 3 o'clock, 3 a.m. But I got over that. One night I was watching a silly movie. I fell asleep, and the next thing I know, I woke up at 7 o'clock, and I'm like, oh my God, it really is going to be okay. Another thing that worried me that I like to tell the newcomers is that when I stopped drinking, who am I going to be with? I was always with my drinking friends. You know, if I can't be with them, if I lost my job, what's going to happen to me? And it was nice that coming into the meetings and meeting people that were the same as me, you know, I quickly learned that I don't have to worry about that. There's a whole another group of people out there that are going to remember me, because these drinking people, 3 weeks after that I was gone from the golf course, you know, they didn't care anymore. But the people in AA, you know, I knew that if I didn't, they didn't see me in a few days or something, they would give me a call, throw me a text. And that was great. So I was very fortunate to have some good sobriety, people around me with good sobriety early on. I got jobs, just like Rebecca said. I was the Grapevine representative for Springfield. I did that for a few months. And then I decided, I had been meeting up with a friend of mine who I reconnected with on Facebook, and she was up here in York. She was in Agunquit when I was meeting up with her. And I was coming up and visiting her and stuff. And then I started, when I was up here, I went to some meetings up here. And she just threw it out there. She said, "Gail, why don't you just, you know, come up for the summer and, you know, get a place to live and work, you know, a summer at the beach." So what the hell, I did it. And then the next thing I know, here I am. Here I am. 10 years later, I never went home. My oldest daughter was all right with that. She could understand that I was in a, I was probably in a better place. The AA up here is a little bit different than in Western Mass. I really enjoyed the spiritual aspect of it. I never had a problem with the God thing. So I was very fortunate in that aspect. And I've stuck to the program, and I've been out on the edge. And I was out on the edge right before COVID. And when these Zoom meetings started and I was stuck in the house, it was like a godsend to me. I got right back into my recovery. I grew in my program. I was able to become the chairperson of the Big A, which I always wanted to be. But I'll probably go down in history as being that COVID chairperson. But that's okay. It's been great. We've got an awesome group. It's where I celebrated my first anniversary 10 years ago. And it's where I find people that are like me, that have the same problems as me, that think like me, and that don't think I'm a weirdo if I tell them the way I'm thinking. They laugh at me and they relate. And it's it was awesome to be here. And thank you so much, Rebecca and Steve, for coming and joining me. I wasn't sure this morning if it was just going to be the Gail show, but I'm glad that I had a couple of people to step up. And Mary, thank you again for your group coming, and I hope that we get to see you